we end up crowding out all of the kind of nuanced information and judgment it takes to actually make things effective. And so I draw a distinction between actually having impact or actually being effective in the pursuit of development or the goals of a specific project and justifying that it's the case.
You are listening to In Pursuit of Development with Dan Banik.
In an excellent book on how aid agencies manage foreign aid projects, my guest argues that tight top-down controls and a focus on target setting and metrics often lead aid projects astray. If one navigates from the top, one may achieve more management control, more oversight, and more standardized behavior. But this may be at the cost of flexibility and adaptability. By contrast, if one empowers those closest to the ground and focuses on what field agents can see and learn, we may apply so-called soft information that will in turn allow for more flexibility. Managing large organizations is never easy, and most politicians and bureaucrats struggle to find the right balance between when to control and when to let go. In the book, Navigation by Judgment, Why and When Top-Down Control of Foreign Aid Doesn't Work, Dan Hoenig argues that a misplaced sense of what it means to succeed encourages many aid agencies to get the balance wrong. Dan is an assistant professor of international development at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He's currently a visiting fellow at Leiden University's Institute of Political Science and a non-resident fellow at the Center for Global Development. He was previously special assistant and then advisor to successive ministers of finance in Liberia and also ran a local non-profit in East Timor that focused on helping post-conflict youth realize the power of their own ideas. Dan is now busy completing his next book on mission-driven bureaucrats, which explores the relationship between motivation, management practice, organizational mission, and performance in the public service. In this conversation, Dan and I discuss the role of ideas and buzzwords in development, how we should measure development impact, and how and why the concept of navigation by judgment is a critical managerial tool that can help maximize the positive impact of aid. I hope you enjoy our conversation. It's great to have you on the show, Dan. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's really wonderful to be here. I've been a longtime listener. It's really an honor to be a guest and to join you here.
I've enjoyed reading your work on foreign aid, Dan. And let's begin with how these days there's always this kind of attention on making or achieving maximum impact, right? In foreign aid circles, it's all about effectiveness and impact. And in your brilliant book, you argue that putting frontline aid workers in charge may often be a much better strategy to ensure impact and effectiveness of aid than these more top-down controls to manage aid delivery. But before we get into the book, I want to begin by asking you to reflect on, if you can, the role of ideas or all of these buzzwords in development, Dan, because the pursuit of development isn't really an easy task, is it? Because every day people like you and me and others are proposing new solutions, new terms, you know, trying to give hope to people, trying to resolve complex problems that they haven't been able to resolve before. So what do you think about all of these new ideas and buzzwords? Because one thing is to come up with them. Another thing is to actually operationalize them and also persuade the people doing this in the field that they should actually adopt them. But that is not always easy, is it?
Yeah, I totally, totally agree. And, you know, I think it's a really interesting place to start, sort of like the role of ideas and the role of the kinds of things that we do, the kinds of frames we provide. I mean, you know, I guess, you know, so when you call something a buzzword, immediately, I think we're biased against it. You know,
right.
And when something becomes just a term, you know, when it becomes kind of unmoored from sort of particular actions or particular ways of thinking systematically about what it means and what it means to do whatever the thing is, I think that is almost inevitable that it kind of loses effectiveness and becomes just kind of part of the script. But I don't think that means ideas don't matter. In fact, I think they matter quite a bit. And I think the fact that development sees so many sort of new concepts and in some sense a kind of cycling between ideas, right? So, mm-hmm. you know, let's be more rigorous, you know, let's think more about the nature of participants, you know, let's think about to what I'm focused on, you know, let's think about management strategy, et cetera. I mean, I think this, you know, part of it is natural, and part of it is a sign of kind of like a fairly deep, I would say, dysfunction in the field, which is mm-hmm. that there is a disconnect between the kind of universe of decision making and thinking and, you know, institutions of the global north in which we both sit and the reality of what the task is. And, you know, I love the name of your podcast in the sense that, you know, in pursuit of development, like, you know, the American constitutional in pursuit, you know, the pursuit of happiness.
That's correct.
Yeah, it's about the journey, right? So, you know, development, we can all define it differently. We can all conceive of the actions that are going to contribute to it differently. But what unites the field is a common desire to pursue it, even in its kind of like multiplex forms. And so mm-hmm. I think it's inevitable that we end up with a lot of different ideas there. I do think that there's the sort of pure view that merely introducing a concept is going to change things is usually not going to be the case, because that concept comes into like a, you know, a rich sort of political economy and organizational incentives, et cetera, et cetera. I also think sort of ignoring ideas probably isn't going to get us very far either. I think we've both seen in our careers and our lifetimes that ideas do, if messily, move what people think and how they act and the concerns that are top of mind as they think about development interventions and our shared project to make the world better.
Yeah, indeed. You know, some years ago, some of my students, after hearing me, and this was a course in development studies, they heard me talk about all the stuff that didn't work, all the bad things in development. And as academics, we are always critical to everything. And they challenged me at the end of the term to come up with a talk that focused on what worked in development, you know, like success stories.
Yeah, sure.
And because of these students, I actually developed a module. I did a MOOC, you know, a massive open online course. And for many years, I've been interested in actually trying to understand or balance this between, you know, all the stuff that doesn't work, but also what actually works. But Dan, I've also understood now increasingly that in the aid world, and this is something I see in your book too, and in your work, in your articles, that there is sometimes perhaps too much pressure to prove that an aid project is successful, right? That there may be the pressure of results, the need to legitimize yourself, your actions vis-a-vis the domestic audience of perhaps angry taxpayers that, you know, are worried that expensive aid transfers are not having an impact, and all of these corrupt leaders are, you know, misusing funds, the pressure to tell if you're an aid worker in the field, the pressure to tell your bosses back home, everything is fine so that they themselves can then report to their political masters that everything is working well. So what I'm trying to get to is this problem I've sometimes observed where, you know, what you term as field agents or aid workers or even NGOs may not sometimes be very keen to talk openly about what is not working for fear of losing funding or for fear of jeopardizing their careers or their financial future or the financial future of their organization. So is there too much pressure to prove that what they're doing is successful?
The short answer is yes. The long answer is I think it's a lot about the nature of the proof. You know, so and what I mean by that is, first, I totally agree with the diagnosis, right? So often people in the field have not just no incentive to discuss sort of failure or even anything other than overwhelming success positively, you know, in sort of, you know, and discuss. I guess what I would say is, you know, as you point towards, to know if we're doing something well, we have to be able to sort of accept our failures and think about what's gone wrong, you know. But I think that a big part of this dysfunction is in the nature of the proof that we require all the way along the way, which is usually in the form of sort of quantitative metrics, things that can be reported, summary statistics, et cetera.
Right.
You know, and in this sense, it relates a lot to the last podcast that you did, at least the last one to post with Jim Scott, and this idea of, you know, what happens when we try to make things legible from afar, when, you know, in Scott's terms, high modernism means that we focus on the things that can be observed from kind of the helicopter above the city plan,
right,
as he put it in that podcast, you know? And I think that what that means is that we end up crowding out, you know, all of the kind of nuanced information and judgment it takes to actually make things effective. And so, you know, I draw a distinction between actually having impact or actually being effective in the pursuit of development or the goals of a specific project and justifying that it's the case. You know, so one of my papers has the title, When Reporting Undermines Performance. Mm-hmm. And I think in some ways that's the central, most solvable dysfunction that I see in this kind of organizational system. And that's this idea that, you know, by codifying everything, by hitting targets, not only do we not allow programs to be sort of adaptive, as is often a conversation these days in aid agencies, I think rightly so, but also we restrict what it means to have impact to the kinds of outputs that often become unmoored from the actual development objective that they were once good proxies for, but stop being good proxies for when we put pressure upon them to report on sort of development success.
Mm-hmm.
And so I advocate for kind of incorporating more judgment, incorporating more soft information, tacit knowledge, Jim Scott might say MEDIS, into the pursuit of development and building systems where we adjudge impact and think about accountability as something different than merely what can be counted and reported up a hierarchy. You know, I often say that, you know, so almost every aid agency has a version of the statement, we're committed to, you know, making every penny count, every krona count, right?
Right.
And I guess my perspective is that we don't make every penny count by counting every penny or even measuring every quantitative output of the project, but rather by thinking kind of more holistically about what we're trying to achieve and empowering the field agents, the NGOs, you know, local leaders, those, you know, further down the delegation chain in a kind of principal agent sense, mm-hmm. and empowering their judgment because they're the only ones with the relevant information to make good decisions. And so we need to rely on that to get the best possible aid outcomes.
Well, that's one of the many reasons why I really liked reading your book, Dan. It really is fascinating reading, and I will recommend it to every person I know in various aid agencies. I can be your manager.
Thank you. Promoting your book. I mean, I'm always in need of a hype man. All hype men are good. So thank you, Dan, for that.
I've decided that I should perhaps stop being a professor and become a professional podcaster. But before we discuss the book in detail, I was wondering whether we could discuss a bit about measurements, because
sure.
And I know this is something also that you've been working on, because there has been, right, in recent years, this kind of trend towards more data, more quantification, as you were just mentioning. And some of it, I suppose, is because of all of these ambitious global goal setting projects that we've undertaken. It could be the Millennium Development Goals and now their success of the SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals. And the critique has been that you can have ambitious goals, but the indicators themselves are very off-putting. They could perhaps only measure one little thing. And there's been this critique that by measuring these indicators, you're not really saying something about these ambitious goals. But nonetheless, these goal setting projects have made us focus much more on measurement. And there's also been this movement from measurement outputs to a focus on evaluating impact. Some have been arguing for rigorous randomized trials, but even these techniques have often been criticized for not really always being the gold standard, and they're not really perhaps able to capture these RCTs, these complex, often political dynamics on the ground. And in some of your work, I've also seen that perhaps impact is easier to measure in some sectors than others. So what I'm trying to get at, and I'd like to ask you, is how should we perhaps rethink measurement, Dan? What are the typical problems that measurement techniques and processes face, and how can we measure smarter?
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. And thanks for teeing up what very much is the kind of heart of my answer to that, which is that, you know, it's very much a kind of horses for courses strategy. That is to say, you know, it's not only do we need to change the actual measures we use in different sectors, some sectors are more tractable, or some projects are more tractable to certain kinds of sort of measurement and RCT laden, those things often go together, approaches than others, right? Mm. So, you know, so I'd say the first question is diagnostic, right? So like, what world are we in? So let me give a couple hypothetical, invented on the spot examples, right? Okay. So if we're trying to build a road, then, you know, if we're trying to build a road in sort of a relatively stable place in known soil, et cetera, we probably can come up with a fairly coherent plan at the beginning. And indeed, we probably should have something like a blueprint approach, which often gets criticized, but, you know, in this case might make a lot of sense. And it might make sense to pre-specify not just the outcomes, but also the outputs, you know, or at least the stages along the way, and to observe and even measure quantitatively, rigorously, whether we've done it. You know, if we wanted to know if one road building technique worked better than another, I think an RCT is a great way to do that. And, you know, that sort of regime, that epistemic regime, that kind of way of knowing about the world, I think is probably going to serve us fairly well. In other cases, we can't look at the process, but we can see the outcome. And that is really the paradigmatic case for kind of, you know, payment for results or contracting on outcomes or impact, as you put it, right? So, you know, that could be a case like, we can't observe the production process of the childhood nutrition program very well, but we can see rates of stunting, which is what we really care about. And, you know, we can evaluate different ways of doing it. In that case, we might not want to have a blueprint type approach. We might want to give people quite a bit of flexibility. But there again, on the kind of impact side, we could do an RCT and, you know, look at stunting as an outcome and understand reasonably well at least which intervention worked better, though why would be another question, and we might want to kind of dig into that with other evidence. But there's a whole range of questions, and those involve, but are by no means limited in my view, to things that involve politics or political economy, mm-hmm. where we're unlikely to get a good stable measure for either, you know, either on kind of outputs or on outcomes. And so, you know, one kind of example, which is more political, would be something like, you know, I don't know, a civil service reform program, right? Where we might need to adapt and navigate along the way, and where it's pretty hard to come up with what our outputs or outcomes would look like, how we'd know if we'd done a good job. Also pretty hard to randomize the civil service, you know, until we invent cloning machines or something like that, you know, very hard to look at that way, or to treat one group but not the other, because we'll have spillovers, a bunch of other issues, et cetera. But, you know, it also can be much simpler things like, I don't know, delivering capacity building programs, right?
Yes.
And you know, capacity building programs often, so in the U.S. government, the sort of standard measures for aid projects are run by the Foreign Assistance Bureau at the U.S. State Department. And I explain that to explain why they're called the F indicators, because that mm-hmm. is the Foreign Assistance Bureau. And I think the F indicators are incredibly well-named, because I would give many of them an F were I to evaluate them. and one of the ones I would give an F is the standard indicator for training, which is number of people trained, right? You know, if I went back in time, if no one had any incentive to report this number, and I looked at trainings that happened before anyone was thinking about this and said, okay, which trainings touched more people and which touched fewer, that feels to me like a plausible, not an answer, but a plausible input into seeing which program was more effective. But of course, as soon as we put pressure on that measure in a kind of managerial sense, as soon as we say, okay, what you, the NGO, or you, the USAID, or NORAD, or CETA field personnel need to report on is how many people got trained. Well, I mean, we can see immediately how that is going to maximize something other than the actual goal of delivering useful information or new ways of thinking to people who are maximally able to use them. Mm-hmm. And indeed, if halfway along the way we realize, oh, you know, what's happening, you know, so I used to work in, I used to run a nonprofit in East Timor. And I remember a program that came in and provided wonderful training to agricultural extension workers working for the Timorese government. And what those extension workers then did with the skills that they had developed is quit the public service and go work for private firms where they could now make more money. So it was indeed capacity building on an individual level, but if the goal of the program was to improve agricultural extension, it maybe did not accomplish that purpose. And if we make our ways of knowing about kind of the best possible metric, even when that's not a very good metric, we're going to run into some of those problems and we're going to get, you know, exactly what we measured rather than what we hoped for. There's a famous management paper by a gentleman, I believe, named Steve Kerr, though I now realize that shares a name with a famous basketball player and coach. So possibly that's not right. But in any case, it's Kerr. And the title is The Folly of Measuring A While Hoping for B. And I think this folly is relatively endemic in development, but it's not uniformly distributed. And the first question we need to ask, just to end where I began too many minutes ago, perhaps, the first question we need to ask ourselves is sort of, what world are we in? How good are our measures? And if our measures are pretty good, but not awesome, maybe we need to do things very, very differently.
I'm glad you mentioned the East Timor example, because that's how you start your book. I think that is a great example of just perhaps measuring the wrong things and in the process losing our focus on what the real purpose was with the intervention, with the project, when you train people and they end up leaving. And who can blame them if they want to move to another more lucrative profession, right?
Yeah.
And this applies to, it could apply to nurses in Malawi who, you know, may be trained by the government that spends a lot of money and end up in the UK because they, of course, get, you know, much better salaries and better working conditions than they would in Malawi. So when you were talking about capacity building, it reminded me of some projects that I've been involved in. I have to say that I actually don't like that term capacity building. I feel sometimes it can be a bit derogatory. It's like, you know, A, building somebody's capacity
totally.
For B.
Totally. Whereas
even empowerment is one of those terms. It's like, I'm empowering you in relation to somebody else.
I put on the list target communities, right? So there's one group of people aiming and another who are the targets of the intervention.
Right.
Yeah, so I use the term entirely because it's conventional, not because I like it.
This is mainstream, so everybody uses it, and fine. But even when we think we've measured impact, Dan, attributing these, whatever we measure, to a specific intervention isn't always easy, is it? And you were talking about civil service reform or, you know, anything that has to do with capacity building. We have to somehow, we end up coming up with measurable things that maybe are not important in the long run, but these are extremely important for reporting, for showing that this project had an impact. And I sometimes feel that this whole results framework approach in aid, you know, this could be some, I find it perplexing. How do you use these neat categories of activities and outputs and impacts? I sometimes just don't understand how I could even claim that some activities and their outputs have had an impact. So I struggle to precisely identify these neat categories. What would your suggestion be for aid workers, for scholars, for others interested in understanding the linkage? Should we be adopting something other than this kind of typical results framework approach?
Yeah, I think we should. And I agree completely, again, with the way you kind of describe the state of things and, you know, the reliance on kind of log frames and results frameworks. And I should say, in saying that, I don't think we shouldn't care about results. I just think when caring about results is in tension with caring about results frameworks, we should care about the results, not the frameworks, right? And similar to what you said about attribution, you know, my friend and co-author and in many ways mentor, Lant Pritchett, has a paper called Let's All Play for Team Development, right? Or at least that's a key phrase in the paper. And, you know, sometimes playing for team development means it's not going to be clear who, you know, who scored the basket, I don't know, to torture the metaphor, for team development. And when that's true, you know, we all know that sports teams work better when the individuals on the team care about the collective goal, in that case, winning the game, rather than their individual stats. And almost every sport has a kind of language for talking about players who kind of look good on paper, but don't contribute to the collective goal. And I think we see that in development. And I think the focus on what can be kind of reported, particularly in a kind of narrow, attributable, often quantitative metric laden way, is part of the problem there. And when that happens, I just want to, you know, this is less me making a point and more pulling out a point that was kind of implicit in your framing there. When that happens, that's not just a transaction cost. It's not just kind of like a hassle to write that up and report it. It actually distorts the activity that gets done. And so we end up with, you know, a lesser chance of victory in our match against whatever the problem is that we're collectively trying to address. And in your case, in the case you gave, civil service reform. And, you know, so what alternative frameworks are there, which is kind of the question you asked. I mean, so there are some suggestions of different ways of doing it. So in their book, Building State Capability, Andrews, Pritchett, and Wolcott proposed the idea of a kind of search frame rather than a log frame.
I like that book.
Me too.
And Lant was here in Norway, and he gave a talk at NORAD a couple of years ago. I enjoyed that.
Awesome. Yeah, that's great to hear. And, you know, it's a lovely book too, because it's kind of half diagnosis, half prescription, and, you know, kind of ways of, here's why we think what we think, and here's what you can do about it. I will say that, you know, in my empirical work, in some ways, the interventions that are most effective do so by essentially gaming the results framework, right? So what do I mean by gaming in this sense? I mean, you know, we write in metrics that we think will be satisfied without our activity at all, right? So things that are just going to happen because of secular trend. And that gives us the space and flexibility to do good work and treat accountability in practice differently than we do. Of course, that all has to be kind of in the breach of the way the official system is meant to work. You know, Ross Ibin has this wonderful paper called Hiding Relations. And this is a kind of hiding relations move, right? So where what's actually functionally de facto how we manage our intervention is very different than the kind of results framework we're in. But, you know, if I was to kind of suggest something more systematic and something that didn't require kind of operating in the shadows of the agency, I would say that, you know, the place to start is again with a question of diagnosis. So where are our results frameworks distortionary, which is something we can think about systematically? Where they're distortionary, what alternative sort of ways of achieving accountability for results can we conceive? I think, you know, in development, there's this. So it took me a long time. As I talked about this book at aid agencies, I would often get this question, which I found totally confusing, if I'm honest, like the first three or four times somebody asked it. So the typical way of asking this question would be to say something like, you know, Dan, you know, you've just presented all this quantitative and qualitative stuff. I think I agree with this diagnosis. It is the case that our management systems or maybe our results frameworks are getting in the way. But, you know, we care about accountability. And so how can we achieve accountability? Doesn't this undermine accountability? And what I found confusing about that is, you know, if we have a view like what we're trying to do is maximize results or maximize value for money or something like that, then if you've conceded in the premise of the question that the thing we're talking about, you don't have to agree with me, but if we're in agreement that the thing in question reduces value while costing money, right? Or it reduces value for money, it undermines results, then, you know, what does it mean to say it doesn't give me accountability if accountability is meant to be a kind of tool to achieve that outcome. And, you know, I guess over time, I've adopted the view that in this sector, there is a kind of implicit view that what it is to be accountable is to count things, is to measure and report them. But of course, accountability can be achieved in lots of different ways. And the dictionary definition of accountability is all about kind of giving account, justification, understanding, not about sort of quantitative or even qualitative reporting in a kind of way that can go in an annual report. And I think, you know, a system that gets beyond the sort of distortionary results framework needs to be one where there is more kind of conversation, more kind of interrogation of judgment. That's why the book's called Navigation by Judgment, rather than a reliance on kind of what we can codify and transmit, you know, thin information in the James Scott sense rather than thick information or the Geert sense.
That's a great point. I enjoyed reading that paper where you actually reflect on your book tours. I'll include it in the show notes so that others can. I think that's a great thing. You know, sometimes it's just nice for us to refine our thought process after we've written a book and got the feedback. Now, we'll return to this slightly later into the conversation, Dan, but you have coined this very attractive phrase, navigation by judgment. And this, as I understand it, is about allowing these personnel of international development organizations, and we'll return to how you understand these organizations. I mean, one of the things I notice is that you don't really talk about NGOs. It is much more of these banks and aid agencies. But anyway, it's about allowing these personnel of these organizations to incorporate so-called soft information and information that field agents can observe, but that, as you were just saying earlier, that can't be easily codified or verified by their supervisors sitting in their offices at headquarters in a donor country or somewhere really far away. What I really like about this concept of navigation by judgment is that it's actually allowing projects, development projects, to be more flexible. If this kind of thinking is adapted, it'll be more flexible. One could adapt to changing circumstances. And you've been arguing that navigation by judgment is a critical managerial tool that could help maximize the positive impact of aid. Now, before we get into the nitty-gritties, and I know that you've written about it, but for the listeners, I'd like you to briefly reflect on how this concept of navigating by judgment can be distinguished from the terms or related terms like autonomy and discretion.
So I should say, you know, at the outset, I don't care what color the cat is, as long as it catches my school of thought on concepts, right? So to the extent that navigation by judgment overlaps with terms you find more useful, you know, whether it be autonomy or discretion or doing development differently or problem-driven iterative adaptation or thinking and working politically or any of the other acronyms that threaten to become buzzwords in the sense we started the conversation with in development, I'm totally fine with that. But I guess the reason I coin a new term here is because, you know, autonomy and discretion. So discretion's usually kind of, I think, conventionally is thought of as what is granted usually by politicians to implementers, right? So at least in public administration, public policy, discretion normally means a sort of grant of a zone of independent action. And autonomy is the agent's ability to act independently, which could be the result of a grant of discretion, or it could be sort of seized, right? So I might act autonomously because, you know, there's a span of control problem and my supervisor can't supervise me even though they're meant to. And so I have autonomy to do more of what I want. And, you know, navigation by judgment is, as I mean it, a sort of managerial, exactly as you put it, a managerial strategy to be taken by bureaucrats for bureaucrats in some sense, though, of course, as with everything in a public agency, that has to kind of relate to a political authorizing environment, as I talk about in the book. But, you know, the idea basically is that those at senior levels of an agency can decide, can elect to manage their agency in such a way as to empower the judgment of those closer to the ground, in that sense, giving them autonomy. Or if we want to think about it in a non-political sense, giving them greater discretion, but where that discretion is in some sense a zone of independent action, and in some sense is a different way of kind of thinking about how their actions are evaluated and how we work collectively to sort of inform our judgment and to become better practitioners of whatever it is we're attempting to do. And in that sense, you know, navigation by judgment is, so the cover of the book is a gentleman at the steering wheel of a boat, right? And the cover image is, and this is in Gloucester, Massachusetts, which is a seafaring town. It's the setting of the movie The Perfect Storm, for those, and the book, I guess. It was a book before it was a movie. And so shows you which I was exposed to first, then I think of it as a movie first. But you know, and basically the reason I use it as the cover is because I think, you know, fishing fleets are roughly analogous here, in that, you know, there is a managerial strategy, which is that we are best off having the person who steers the boat be the one who is actually on the ocean, as you say, able to adapt and respond to the waves with their hand on the wheel, rather than trying to navigate by GPS from shore. And, you know, you could describe that as, I don't know, a corporate approach to give people sufficient autonomy or to grant discretion over boat behavior or something like that. But I guess I think of it more naturally as a decision that this is a profession where we should navigate by judgment, where a managerial strategy should be such that we make sure that those centrally responsible for guiding what happens at the coalface are those closest to the coalface.
I think you make a very persuasive argument there. I'm just thinking about how you would consider the fact that we as individuals, we are very different. Some of us like to talk. Some of us are very quiet. Some of us are, you know, can be provocative. And to what extent do you see personalities determining the kind of feedback or this kind of the judgment? So sometimes, you know, I believe that I know what I'm talking about and I know I'm right. And sometimes I can make a persuasive case for others. At other times I'm unsure. So it's only when somebody else says it that I feel, oh, I should have said it first, you know? So how do you think individual personalities are important in this argument that you make? If you're a junior, you may be, you know, fearful of saying basically what you mean because your senior would say, you know, you don't have any experience, you know, you don't know anything you're talking about, so just shut up. It could be the political culture of the organization, right? It could be how the relationship is between juniors and middle-level management and seniors. All of this factors in, does it not?
Totally. Yeah. And to kind of start at the where you started with kind of personalities, and you know, and also the fact that like we could be wrong, right? So it certainly is sometimes true that I think I know what I'm talking about, and my wife disagrees that I know what I'm talking about the thing we're talking about, and you know,
my wife always disagrees with me.
Right? Yeah, I made it sound as if it was a sometimes situation. It might be closer. No, and you know, and she is oft right about that, right? And so you know, it's not simply kind of like dispositional. There's also the simple fact that people will differentially make good decisions if faced with the same circumstances, not just express those decisions differently. And, you know, to make the problem even a little bit harder for myself, people are going to differentially care about making good decisions, right? And it is certainly the case that what I'm advocating is a managerial system that's going to allow those who care the least to do less, right? So if we imagine somebody who truly wants to shirk in whatever job, this is not, I don't think this is very common in aid agencies or NGOs to what you rightly framed in before, or anywhere in the system, or recipient country governments for that matter. But to the extent there are those who don't care about the objective, more shirking should be possible when in a navigation by judgment system. You know, I think we often imagine that if something flows through the heart and head of an individual, that it can't be thought about systematically. And what I mean by that is we already have a system wherein individuals come into an agency or are at an agency, experience a management practice and respond to it. And I know many people, I suspect you also know many people, who have left the profession or have left aid agencies precisely because they find that while working for these agencies, they cannot actually engage in the laudable sort of welfare-enhancing actions that brought them to the field in the first place. And so I think there are selection dynamics that work the other way too, in the sense that I think we often systematically experience adverse selection out of precisely the kinds of people or some of the people who would be most kind of amenable to, who would achieve the greatest results under a navigation by judgment kind of regime. And so, you know, there will always be heterogeneity, variation in how people respond to any management practice. And I think we should think about, as an agency manager, I think I should think about that and evaluate that and figure out what is working for whom and, you know, adjust. And some people are not appropriate for certain tasks. Some people are not appropriate even for certain agencies. And that's a natural part of labor markets. You know, we can think about merely because it involves personalities and dispositions and those kinds of dynamics need not mean we can't think about it systematically. And I think we should, and it would be our benefit to do so. We can also group tasks. So one of the things I suggest in the conclusion of the book is, you know, to the extent there are people of different orientations inside the agency, you know, I mean, to the hypothetical I gave before, you know, if certain kinds of people are better for the kind of road building projects, and certain kinds of people are more naturally inclined towards the, what was it, stunting reduction projects, mm-hmm. and others are more inclined to deal with the inherent messiness and insecurity and judgment of the civil service projects. We can think about that. It need not involve entry and exit, though it can. You know, in terms of actually getting it done, which is where you turned with the kind of mention of the different levels of the agency and also with your note about kind of politics. So, you know, let me start with the politics side, which is, you know, I think a lot of folks who work in aid agencies and might be listening to this podcast have already had the thought, like, this sounds lovely for a pointy-headed academic to have this idea, but, you know, I've got to work in the real world. And the fact that these numbers are, you know, distortionary, I totally agree with, but what am I going to do about that, right? And, you know, it's certainly right that political authorizers, you know, what, you know, executive boards and parliaments and such want to see is going to matter here. But there too, I think there's an opportunity for more dialogue, right? So I once had a conversation with an aid skeptic important in the political environment in America, let me say, to which he said, I would like to, if I could, eliminate all foreign aid. And I said, okay, fair enough. I mean, we disagree about that. But as long as it exists, would you rather it actually helped the people it went to or did not? Would you rather the system, you know, provide you information that looked good but did not actually achieve the result or did not? You know, you might care about winning hearts and minds, and I might care about improving welfare, but we share a goal that instrumental on the project existing, it would be nice if it actually accomplished its actual goals rather than only seeming to do so in a kind of Pyrrhic victory that actually accomplished very little. And I think there's room to change that conversation. And I think that, you know, one of the things, if you don't mind me turning, I know this has been a long response already. So, you know, turning to the kind of levels question you had. I mean, so, you know, you mentioned the kind of like, you know, what I learned on my summer vacation book tour paper, which is a CGD working paper. Mm-hmm. And thank you for bringing that up. You know, in some ways, I wrote that paper and what the preface of that paper is kind of all about is, you know, I had a theory of change when I wrote the book, which was lots of people maybe don't realize that this reporting system, that, you know, the results framework kind of world is undermining performance. And when I, you know, went around talking about the book, what I realized is I was largely wrong about that, at least as regards people who work at aid agencies, that is, and NGOs, I should say, as well. That is, there is widespread agreement with this diagnosis. What there isn't is a sense of what to do about it. You know, I mean, as somebody senior in an aid agency once put it, this is fantastic, Dan. You've used sophisticated methods to show us what we already knew. what can you say that we don't already know? And, you know, I think that one of the things I think I can say that at least many people seem not to already know, or at least some, is how widely this diagnosis is shared, right? So people often sort of feel the need to confidentially tell me that they think this is a spot-on sort of way of thinking about it, but that, you know, they're alone in their agency in thinking so, even if they're the 30th person in their agency to tell me that over the course of 2 days walking the halls, right? And I think the, you know, to your question of kind of what people at different levels of the organization can do, I think there is a kind of pluralistic ignorance about this, you know, that is many people are not aware of how widely their views are shared. And starting to push back or ask questions, you know, you framed specifically a junior person in the agency, you know, asking questions like, why is it this way? You know, is there a rule or is that a custom? You know, I don't understand, I'm new here. You know, what can be done differently? These are good questions to ask. And in some ways, those at the junior levels of the agency, in addition to often being the closest to implementation, depending on the agency and the role, also have the advantage of it not yet being a career, right? If you're junior in an aid agency and you joined your agency because you cared about development impact, wouldn't you rather see if you can move your agency in that direction? And if not, find any of the other myriad wonderful things to do that you could do to achieve that impact? In some ways, I think junior folks have the least to lose, in part because they have the least long histories in their agencies. But I think there are things that all of us can do. And, you know, in that paper, what I do basically is I collect all of the good ideas I heard from various people in various agencies, anonymize them, and then present them as if they're my ideas, which they aren't. You know, but I'm clear I'm doing that, by the way. You know, and I think there are lots of wonderful suggestions and lots of things that people are, in fact, doing to try to achieve the aid impact, the development impact, the pursuit of development.
In a way, it seems like you are advocating for a bit more activism, or if you're working in this field, that we can't be as perhaps impersonal as if we were a bureaucrat within any other ministry or whatever, that maybe we have to show a bit more interest and vigor in trying to change. And that is what I was actually trying to get at in the earlier question, that it doesn't come naturally, I suppose, to a lot of people. But when you were replying to my earlier question, Dan, I was also thinking about the role of knowledge and solution. So if I, let's say, join an aid agency, and a lot of the people who work in aid agencies, say in this country, I've taught them, and I don't know if I did a good job or not, but I hope that when they do join the agency, they are pretty much aware of the state of the art, the literature, and whether there are actually concrete solutions. And sometimes, as you know, there aren't any direct solutions or concrete solutions on the way forward. It is more about navigating difficult terrain, right? It is about maybe feeling your way through, as the Chinese say, you know, crossing the river while feeding the stones. And I think in those situations, maybe it is much more difficult to provide that kind of feedback to say, hey, this path is wrong, we should be changing paths. And I sometimes have been, you know, a bit frustrated with the kind of Jeffrey Sachs argument that we know what is to be done. We need money. Just give us the money. And we know. I don't think it is as easy as that.
Yeah, so I mean, hard for me to criticize Jeffrey Sachs in that he shares my tiny hometown of Oak Park, Michigan. So, you know, you're speaking to the second most prominent and probably only other development scholar from Oak Park, Michigan at the moment. So that said, I agree entirely that solutionism only gets us so far, and that's not very far at all. Before jumping into that, just to say on kind of your point about bureaucrats, it's lovely that you went there. So my current book manuscript is currently titled Mission-Driven Bureaucrats, and it's about public sector agents in the developing and the developed world across a range of bureaucracies, and basically arguing that we often get better outcomes by focusing on sort of supportive management and encouraging, you know, mission-driven action rather than an attempt to kind of monitor and control. And so I do think the argument the kind of agent bit that we've been talking about travels relatively widely, though. And in a few years when that book is out, I would love the opportunity to come and try to convince you and your audience.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That's very, very kind. But, you know, on the kind of question of what your students do, what my students do at Johns Hopkins SAIS as they enter agencies, I think the crossing the river by feeling the stones metaphor is really an eloquent one. And we can sort of pick up from there in some sense. So, you know, I agree entirely. It is very rarely the case that we know that the answer is to, you know, build a bridge over the proverbial river and exactly what kind of cement we should use and what kind of supporting struts, et cetera, et cetera. Where we do, we should do that. And people who want to be in the domain of answering those kinds of questions, there's actually a wonderful and I think fantastic, I am in favor of the infrastructure that supports that work. You know, I have in mind things like, you know, J-PAL and Evidence Action and the world of kind of results-based policymaking in some evidence-based policymaking. I think that world is fantastic. I just think it is far from universally applicable to the range of things development agencies do, and indeed misses many of the most important ones. And there, when we're feeling the stones, well, you know, the way any group of people feels the stones across the river is first as a group, right? It's very hard to do individually. It's easier to do if we kind of collectively discuss where we're going. It's hard to do to go back to exactly where you started. It's hard to do if we're never allowed to take a wrong step as we cross the stones.
That's correct.
You know, it is almost certainly the case that if we can't see all the way across, that we will, if we do that, we're going to end up in, you know, a kind of local maximum. You know, we'll get kind of across the river, but we'll have ended up on a peninsula or close to crossing the river, and we'll need to back up and think about it again. And only if we give ourselves the space to do it are we likely to end up, in fact, feeling our way across the river with the stones. It's also going to be slower, right? So I use a kind of near neighbor metaphor in the book, or perhaps only in talks. I can't remember. It's actually in the volume. I'm sorry. Between two kinds of cars, right? So I'm from Detroit, as I just mentioned, or just outside Detroit. And, you know, we can imagine a kind of, you know, a Corvette is faster than a, you know, than a Jeep on well-paved road, right? If we want to drive the Indy 500 or, you know, the, you know, across Europe's highways, we're going to be better off in the Corvette. We're going to be speedier. But if we try to go off-road, the speed of both cars will fall, but the speed of the Jeep will fall less, right? And we often, I think, make the kind of category error of saying, oh, we have a slow-moving Jeep that's crossing difficult terrain, and then we have a fast-moving Corvette that's on the fast-moving road. So let's celebrate the Corvette. I think that part's right, but let's underinvest in the Jeep. If we think that what the Jeep is doing, if we think the stuff that that matters, or some of the stuff that matters, is best done by feeling our way across the stones, then we need to invest in that, and we need to do so with different systems of accountability and management that have a different understanding of what success and failure is, and accept that, you know, if I walked out, so I'm looking at the road outside me as I as we chat here, and you know, if I walk downstairs, lovely, you know, a 40-something woman walking by with dogs right now. And if I walked downstairs and stopped her and said, how do you manage development projects? I suspect she would not feel she had expertise on that question, I imagine, you know? But I suspect if I asked her, how would you manage a road project and how would you manage a civil service reform project, she would be unlikely to suggest that the same basic framework would be likely to apply to both of those projects. But that's basically the world we live in, a world where we say aid projects are delivered in way X, and then let's think about differences on the margins. Whereas I'm suggesting that conventional wisdom is that almost anyone we could ask would agree that that is probably not a likely route to success, and that they'd be right about that.
I feel I haven't done justice to your book because we really haven't discussed the case studies. So towards the end of this conversation, Dan, could we focus a bit on USAID and DFID projects that you studied in Liberia and South Africa in relation to capacity building and health? And I found it quite interesting that you conclude that, you know, in some instances, navigating by judgment will not work. And you have this really impressive table on page 25 of the book, The Costs and Benefits of Navigating by Judgment. So I'd like us to conclude this conversation by discussing very briefly, if you can, some of the conditions where you think navigating by judgment is useful and some of the conditions where you feel top-down management is the best strategy forward.
Yeah, thank you. And I feel no injustice done to the book, for whatever it's worth, but it's kind of kind of you to say. And so, you know, basically what I theorize and then test in, as you say, these eight case studies looking at USAID and DFID in Liberia and South Africa in health and capacity building, and then complementing that with econometric analysis of 14,000 projects across 40 years, across 180 countries, across every, you know, kind of development sector that's coded, is basically that these are strategies that have differential returns and that are more appropriate for different kinds of tasks. So these being navigation by judgment on the one hand, and, you know, what I call navigation from the top, but we can think of as a kind of, you know, conventional log frame results matrix, you know, quantitative target setting sort of approach. And, you know, basically, this table, which I hope I have in my mind's eye correctly, does indeed summarize what I think the advantages are, which is, you know, some tasks need more agent initiative. They need more soft information. They require more flexibility. And where this is true, we need an approach that is laden with navigation by judgment. But that doesn't mean that this is always going to be the best strategy. And, you know, the case pair that you highlight in the question is one where USAID, which largely navigates from the top, and DFID, which engages, I should say, now FCDO, but of course DFID at the time, so calling them DFID at the moment, the UK aid agency, they navigate more by judgment. And both agencies are trying to deliver basically antiretroviral drugs to pregnant mothers in South Africa as part of prevention of mother-to-child transmission, PMTCT, as it's called, of HIV/AIDS. And, you know, basically, USAID says, let's measure everything. You know, let's put targets on everything. Let's figure out how many pills go into how many mouths. And I'm not sure that's a great way to build, say, the government systems to continue that activity, but it sure does better accomplish the purpose of delivering the drugs to people and cut through. At the time, South Africa was in an era known there as denialism, where official government policy doubted the link between between treatment and HIV/AIDS and doubted the causes of HIV/AIDS, et cetera. Then does DFID strategy, which gets caught up in kind of politics and meetings and, you know, just the general kind of political economy, which is unfavorable to the activity that they're attempting to conduct. And so, you know, I think that's a great case for measures where we have clear metrics that are reliable and will not distort the activity. And what we care about is delivering the thing, we should use them. Where we have clear measures of outcomes that we can evaluate, as in, you know, the road building or even the stunting hypothetical cases I gave, we should use them. You know, when we're delivering vaccines now, you know, in this COVID world and hopefully receding COVID world, hopefully someday, not just for those in the global north, or largely for those in the global north, we should use them. These are our activities that are incredibly important to welfare and which are incredibly tractable to metrics, where what we care about is oversight. What we care about is standardized behavior, where good delivery probably does not involve a lot of judgment, right? So, you know, putting a vaccine into the arm of someone requires only a limited amount of kind of nuanced, soft information that can't be observed from afar. And when that's the case, we should not navigate by judgment. The argument is not that this is a kind of, you know, management answer for all seasons. It is that there are many important seasons where it is indeed far superior to the options we currently are taking. And we don't see that in part because we allow our systems to lie to us, and we encourage them to lie to us. And most people who work in the aid industry, many people at least, agree with this and have to not only labor with that reality, but also work in agencies where they have the sense that what they are doing does not accomplish the thing that they care about doing, or at least they're not aware of what it does because of the way they're asked to think about data and results. And where that's true, that's a shame. It's a shame for the, you know, sort of enjoyment of those jobs, but much more importantly, it's a shame because it means that those dollars from those citizens who are asking for accountability are not optimally spent and sometimes not well spent at all. And to the extent that we as a universe of people, as scholars, as practitioners, are ultimately accountable for that money, by which I do not mean merely counting things. I think we owe it to the citizens of both the developed and the developing world to actually act in pursuit of development rather than in pursuit of a mirage of development that seems like it's making progress, but in fact satisfies no one.
I've had such great fun chatting with you today, my namesake, Dan.
And, my pleasure.
Good luck with your new book, and I'd love to have you back on the show when that is out. So thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you. Really my pleasure. Am I the first Dan to be your guest, Dan?
You are indeed.
Wow, I'm honored. I'm honored to be the second Dan on In Pursuit of Development. And thank you so much for having me. Thanks for the questions. Thanks for the lovely conversation.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please spread the news among your friends and share it on social media. The Twitter handle for this podcast is GlobalDevPod.
Thank you for listening to In Pursuit of Development with Professor Dan Banik from the University of Oslo's Center for Development and the Environment. Please email your questions, comments, and suggestions to inpursuitofdevelopment@gmail.com.